From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest, Dr. Holly Gilbert, who's the director of the Heliophysics Science Division, chief of the Solar Physics Laboratory, and NASA deputy project scientist for the Solar Orbiter, a spacecraft that launched Sunday, February 9th, and is on its way to the sun. It will study electromagnetic characteristics of the solar wind, enabling them to tackle mysteries such as the 11-year cycle of solar activity, the generation of the sun's magnetic field, and how solar wind particles are accelerated to high energies. Dr. Holly Gilbert, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here.
Well, it's really nice to have you here. We've been looking forward to this conversation. NASA has an exciting launch scheduled for this Sunday. Can you tell us about it?
Indeed. Solar Orbiter is a mission with a unique orbit that is going to provide a view of the sun that we've never seen before. The orbit will go out of the ecliptic plane, allowing us to see the north and the south poles of the sun. And this is important because it will help scientists address some of the fundamental questions we still have about the sun. How does the sun shape the space throughout the solar system, and how is it driving activity throughout that space as well? And Solar Orbiter will have a very comprehensive suite of instruments that will take images, but will also measure the plasma in situ. And so it's going to allow us to map from the spacecraft all the way back down to the solar surface, and this is incredibly exciting.
And this is a very unique orbit. I understand that all the planets revolve around the sun on the ecliptic orbit, on the eclipse. And so how do you get into position? I understand there's some slingshotting involved.
That's exactly right. Because the planets are all orbiting in this one plane, we already have motion going that way. So launching into that plane is not as difficult as launching out of that plane. So we have to give it some extra energy to get out of that plane. And we utilize gravity from Venus and Earth. We fly by a few times to then get that kicked out, provide the extra energy to get it kicked out of the plane. And so it's a really fascinating way of doing it, but it is difficult.
Yeah. And in August of 2018, we had some folks on from Goddard talking about the Parker Space Probe, and maybe 9 months later, instruments were calibrated, we had them back on to talk about how things were going. It takes a while to get into position. And at some point, they were saying that through their slingshotting, that the Parker Solar Probe, which sits in the corona, or will observe in the corona, trying to understand just inside the sun's surface, that at some point, it will be traveling at, I believe, 430,000 miles per hour. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's extremely fast, the fastest any man-made object yet. So because it's going so close to the sun, it will really get sped up by that extra gravity.
Okay, so will the Solar Orbiter, as it does its slingshot maneuvers, will it be achieving those sorts of speeds?
The Solar Orbiter will also be getting very close to the sun, not as close as Parker. In fact, with remote sensing instruments, you can't get as close as Parker Solar Probe. And so Solar Orbiter is going within Mercury's orbit, and that is using the slingshots to help get it closer to the sun, but it's also using the slingshots to get it out of that ecliptic plane, which is different than Parker. Great engineering has allowed both of these missions to do things we've not done before.
And we're about 93 million miles away from the sun. I think Mercury is, what, 36 million or so?
I think that's about that.
So this will be inside of Mercury's orbit, maybe 26 million?
In terms of miles, I can't remember, but it is within 0.25 AU, astronomical unit.
Right.
So if you imagine Mercury's orbit and just imagine right inside of that orbit.
So for our listeners, if you are interested in the sun, and if you go and Google Dr. Holly Gilbert, NASA, she has a number of YouTube videos. And Holly, I was looking at a couple YouTube videos this morning, and I was fascinated to find out this one that you were doing on the poles and how they flip every once in a while, that on our home planet here, the poles north and south will flip somewhere between 50 and 100,000 years. That's the frequency. But the sun poles flip every 11 years. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, it's really neat. The sun does have magnetic field like the Earth, but the sun is rotating very quickly and it's not solid like the Earth. So its magnetic structure is more complicated and large, and the poles do indeed flip every 11 years. And this is related to what we call the solar activity cycle. And we don't fully understand why this happens, especially on every 11-year cycle, but Solar Orbiter will help us address some of these questions by getting a better handle on the global magnetic field, which does drive activity. So it's called what we call space weather. And it does happen very fast relative to the Earth, but the sun is a very different beast. And so it does that and so many other things. It's so dynamic, and we have a very interesting parent star that we live with, and we're embedded in its atmosphere, essentially.
Yeah, you know, it's so easy to simplify if you look up into the sky, look at our sun, or look at stars at night to simplify. Well, there's this thing out there. There's many, many nuclear reactions every second, and that's basically it. But the sun is such a complex system. There's so much going on, and I can imagine when those poles are shifting that the magnetics throughout the entire sun are possibly disrupted.
Absolutely. It's very interesting. It's very dynamic in all of its magnetic activity. So as the sun gets higher and higher in terms of activity with sunspots, which are really bundles of strong magnetic fields, and as it's rotating different speeds, both at the equator and at the poles and in the interior, all those magnetic fields get twisted up. And so essentially, they are getting twisted and gaining energy, and then they do release that energy in eruptions. And so the flipping of the poles is kind of that, just that pattern, that cycle of the sun getting more and more and more energetic because of the magnetic fields, and then releasing that energy. And so it's a very fascinating thing. And you mentioned how complex the sun and the system is, and that's exactly why I went into this field. I couldn't believe actually how much we still needed to learn about the star that's in our backyard, essentially.
Yeah, so it's important to understand our sun, but also by doing that, by studying this, we're going to learn about other stars within our known universe. So there's lots of reasons to do that, right?
That's right, yes. We can apply what we have learned and what we do know about the sun and use that to understand other systems and other stars. And it's a great cross-disciplinary subject.
Dr. Gilbert, I'm curious, the Parker Solar Probe will be slingshotting back and forth, but when it's doing its studying, it's going to be inside the corona studying that early part of the sun atmosphere, which is very warm. Will it be communicating with the solar observatory that's moving around the poles?
Absolutely. So we've been working in coordination with that mission as well to have some combined observation campaigns, because what Parker is going, like you said, is going to fly through close, it's kind of the interior of the solar corona, not the far out part. And when it's doing that, there are going to be certain conjunctions once Solar Orbiter launches. Solar Orbiter will be able to image the very region that Parker Solar Probe is flying through, which is a very powerful contextual information. And so that's one way that they can combine their observations. But also, and different conjunctions might allow the Parker to then sample some plasma blowing away from the sun at where closer to the sun, and then Solar Orbiter will be behind that, and it'll be able to sample that same plasma, and then we can see how it evolves and really be able to map it back down to where it originated. And so the two together are extremely synergistic, and we are looking forward to coordinated efforts.
I just figured out that having you as the Deputy Director of Heliophysics Science Division and also NASA Deputy Project Scientist for the Solar Orbiter is probably a good thing. You have a lot of enthusiasm for this project.
I do, and it's even actually different. I'm actually the Director of the Heliophysics Science Division now and the Project Scientist for Solar Orbiter, so I guess my enthusiasm has taken me to higher heights.
Well, that's fantastic. So people, I'm sure, are thinking right now as they're listening to this, how can you study something, and you have to be close to the sun, it's warm, how do you protect your instrumentation package? Can you talk about that?
Sure. We've had some really great advances in technology. And so the heat shield on Solar Orbiter uses a black coating, and it basically absorbs all of that heat. And we have a place behind this heat shield, then it allows it that heat to be given out to the sides so that the instruments right behind it are protected. And so even though the heat shield is very, very hot, the instruments that are behind it are like room temperature. And so it's very important to do that. We haven't been able to do that until now because we had to get the technology advanced and the engineering to advance as much as it did. So both Parker Solar Probe and Solar Orbiter are really neat in that sense.
Yeah, and while you're getting the spacecrafts into position to do your studying, it may not be as much an issue, but at some point you absolutely have to have that heat shield always pointed towards the sun and protecting the instrumentation package. I think you refer to it as a crab walk of sorts. How do you do that? How do you the spacecraft is just been, let's say, slingshot from Venus or from Earth, and it's heading back, and somehow you have to keep that package always facing towards the sun, otherwise, you know, everything would get not incinerated, but probably burnt up.
Ruined, yes, definitely. Ruined. The spacecraft itself is able to keep it pointed at the sun all the time. And so we're able to protect those instruments behind. And we also have remote sensing instruments that will be looking out little windows in that heat shield. And so they will have little doors that open and allow images to be taken. And we can't do that closer to the sun than we already have been with Orbiter. So Parker, for instance, can't have the remote sensing instrumentation because it's just too close for those doors to be opened for the remote sensing. The spacecraft itself keeps its direction facing towards the sun, so that heat shield definitely protects the instruments.
Yeah. Here's the reason I'm really interested to speak with you. I want to hear all about the sun and about the programs and everything, but I understand that your primary focus of research has been coronal mass ejections, CMEs. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. I'm very interested in the dynamic activity that occurs on the sun and how it evolves in terms of space weather.
Well, I'm very interested, too. And I understand that back in July of 2012, there was a large ejection. And I don't know if I can describe this correctly, if the Earth is going in its orbit around the sun, this ejection missed our orbit by 9 days. And it was pretty big. It could have had some, you know, a big impact on things back here on the home planet.
Absolutely. We were lucky in that sense because these huge, massive bubbles of hot plasma and magnetic field do blow away from the sun, and the Earth can be in that path. And when they're very, very large and strong, like the one that happened in 2012 are, if the Earth had been right in its path, it could have caused a lot of damage in terms of our technology, our satellites. It could have caused widespread power grid outages. And so we were lucky. We think that storm was possibly as powerful as one of the strongest ones that we know about that occurred in 1859,
right,
called the Carrington event. So, we don't know exactly how often the most powerful of these storms occur. Hopefully it's on the order of a few hundred years, but yes, so it's that was a very potentially scary one.
Well, I suppose if you could take some electrical systems offline, or you could shut down satellites momentarily or for, you know, some small period of time while the thing's going through, that would be helpful. And I remember back maybe 4 or 5 years ago, interviewing someone from NASA that said, you know, we can do that now. We have the ability to be able to forecast these things. But I read recently that they're very difficult to forecast. They don't travel that fast. They don't travel the speed of light. They travel a million miles an hour, which gives us some time. How long would that take? That would take 93.
So, yeah, it in fact, there's a constant solar wind. The sun is blowing out its outer atmosphere, and that wind is about a million miles an hour. And these larger storms can travel upwards of 4 million miles an hour. And so some of them can reach the Earth within a day. But the solar flares that are associated with these big bubbles, that extra radiation can it travels at the speed of light. And so we have additional radiation that then impacts the Earth's atmosphere. And that can cause issues with satellite drag and radio transmission. And so it kind of has this like 1-2-3 punch. There's the radiation, the extra radiation from the flare, which hits us very quickly within 8 minutes. And then we have the coronal mass ejection, mass and magnetic field that travels. And that usually reaches us between 1 and 3 days. And then we also have particles that are being accelerated to very high energies, being driven by both the flare and the coronal mass ejection. And those are also very fast. So it's a super complicated thing. And it is hard to forecast, especially because the coronal mass ejections, when they're directed at the Earth, unless we have observations on either side, so say at 90 degrees, so we can see those travel, it's hard to judge very accurately the speed with which they're coming. And they're also complicated in their magnetic structure. And so more observations are better, and especially different viewpoints are helpful in that respect. But we do have some forecasting ability, and you're right, we can mitigate some of those effects with our satellite electrical systems, and even the power grids can do stuff that will help. So it's incredibly important to forecast, and we really ultimately want to predict, kind of like we do here on Earth with terrestrial weather.
Well, I think you just answered my next question. Why is space weather important to understand? Yeah. I mean, this is pretty important stuff.
It is, and especially for our technology, our satellites. NASA has a very strong interest because of our satellites, but also our astronauts. Our astronauts are going to be outside of the protective shield of the Earth, the magnetosphere. And so on the ground, we're not directly impacted because of that magnetic field shield and also the atmosphere. But again, our technology and our satellites, our GPS, that can be impacted, and the power grids. But the astronauts are going to be outside of that protection. So it's really important for us to be able to predict and help them out when they go to the moon and to Mars.
Back to July of 2012, had that thing hit us and we did not have the sort of things in place to be able to, rearrange or to shut things down and stuff, could that have knocked down our grid?
Especially parts of it. Now, the grids have been very connected, and they're getting better at having them not as connected, so that when one section of the power grid goes down, it doesn't impact all of the others. So, it's hard to know for sure how that would have ended up. But potentially, yes, we could have widespread power outages for quite a while, and that's pretty scary in terms of not knowing, how people would react. So the transformers that can blow because of these electrical surges, we don't have them sitting on the shelf ready to be replaced. And so we're getting better at preparing and mitigating these effects. But yes, it's complicated, and it could cause a lot of damage.
Yeah, so now when you watch the Mad Max movies, you it's actually a horror film.
Right, yeah. Well, hopefully it wouldn't be quite that bad, but yes, it would be interesting for sure.
It would be interesting, yeah. Boy. So I wanted to ask you, our solar system is so big. The solar wind, the solar weather, does it go out to Pluto and beyond?
It does. So the sun's domain reaches beyond Pluto's orbit. So it again, all that happens on the sun impacts us here at the Earth, but also the other planets and beyond.
Regarding the sun, what one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet?
That's a tough one. I think how the solar cycle works. I think that's a very fundamental question that we don't understand. And so I'm hoping that we can get further understanding on that aspect itself.
Dr. Holly Gilbert, she's the director of the Heliophysics Science Division. We want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
You bet. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org. under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.